handheld phone.
"Tomorrow, just after sunset," Nobo replied.
"Where?"
"At the family home in Kyoto."
"I'll be there," Dan said. There was no need to change his flight to Sydney. Maxwell E. Rutherford would ride the high-boost rocket from Alphonsus to the transfer station in low Earth orbit. There, Rutherford would clear customs and immigration and hop aboard the shuttle to Sydney. Once in Australia, he would take a commercial hypersonic transport to Tokyo, where a security team from Yamagata Industries would take him to Saito's estate. And then Dan Randolph would help his old friend to die. Hell, thought Dan. Sai's not that much older than I am. He's too young to die. Jane Scanwell hosted a party that evening. Although her home was still in Texas, as the head of the American delegation to the Global Economic Council, she spent so much time in Paris that she had leased an apartment in the Embassy District, out past L'Étoile and the Arc de Triomphe, within walking distance of the Bois de Boulogne, for a long-striding Texas woman. This evening, though, she felt a far distance from Texas. Almost all her life had been spent in politics, and she knew that more could be accomplished at a social gathering than in a committee meeting. But she felt weary of it all. The posturing, the jockeying for position, the constant competition to get your point across, your program adopted, your pork barrel filled. "What have we accomplished?" she asked herself as she looked across the roomful of guests. The women wore knee-length frocks decked with jewelry, the men Western business suits, no matter what their native tradition. They stood and chatted and laughed, sipped drinks and nibbled canapés. "But what have we accomplished?" Jane asked silently once again. "I've been to 1,000 parties such as this, 10,000. I've spent my life in politics. So has almost everyone here. Is the world any better off? Are the people happier, healthier, richer?" She shook her head slightly. "There are certainly more people than ever before. 12 billion of them. Maybe we've stabilized population growth. That would be a major accomplishment. Stabilized it at a level where half the world is constantly hungry and the other half resists helping them with every ounce of their strength. At least we've stopped the wars. I suppose that's something to be proud of. We have famines and droughts and floods and millions killed by storms each year, but at least we're not killing each other anymore."
"You seem troubled."
Startled out of her reverie, Jane saw that it was Raffaello Gaetano who had spoken to her. Young, tall, and slim as a cypress tree, darkly handsome, Gaetano was the chief of the Italian delegation to the GEC, the youngest member of the GEC board, and the most ambitious. He was rumored to be strongly linked to the International Crime Syndicate, especially since his first official act upon joining the GEC board had been to propose that the organization move its headquarters from Paris to Palermo in Sicily. Since that day, almost everyone in the GEC sniggered that Gaetano was the mafia representative. Whether it was true or not, whether he heard the whispers or not, Gaetano remained a smiling, hard-working, thoroughly charming member of the GEC board.
"A lady as lovely as you, my dear Jane, should never have to frown," he said, handing her a tulip glass of bubbling champagne. His voice was a deep baritone, melodious. "Tell me what dragon is annoying you, and I will go forth and slay it."
Despite her cares, Jane Scanwell smiled back at him.
"I wish it were that simple, Rafe. I really do."
Gaetano gently took her arm and led her toward the ceiling-high windows of her own living room.
"Look," he said softly.
Yet his voice penetrated the background babble of the crowd.
"All of Paris is out there. You should be enjoying yourself. This is the city of romance, you know."
She arched a brow slightly.
"I'm getting a bit too old for romance, Rafe."
"Nonsense. You are in the prime of your life."
"I wish that were so."
"Let me prove it to you,"
he said, running a finger across his pencil-thin mustache. She looked at him. "Is he serious?" she asked herself. He gazed back at her, smiling a smile that might have been amorous, or just friendly. Or perhaps it was the self-confident smile of a healthy young male with a sensitivity for lonely older women.
There are plenty of younger women here, Jane said at last.
Yes, that is true, he admitted, somewhat ruefully. Then his grin returned. But it took you several moments to arrive at that conclusion. I consider that a good sign.
Then he moved away, without another word. Jane stared after him. What's he after? She heard a voice in her mind ask. And she replied to herself silently, Jane Scanwell, you've been in politics too damned long if you're automatically suspicious of some good-looking young Italian making a pass at you. Trying to force Gaetano's suggestion to the back of her mind, Jane busied herself attending to her guests. Malik had shown up without his wife as usual, and as usual he was the center of a cluster of admiring women of all ages. Jane made polite conversation, saw that the robots weaving through the crowd with trays of drinks were functioning properly, and tried to avoid whichever part of the big high-ceilinged room Gaetano happened to be in. Eventually, inevitably, she slipped out of the crowded living room and strode swiftly down the hall to her cubbyhole of an office. Closing the door firmly behind her, she leaned across her desk and swiveled the phone screen around. She touched a couple of keys and her messages scrolled silently across the screen. There. Dan's reply to her invitation. On my way, you know who. Jane crossed her arms over her chest and frowned at the screen. Damn you, Dan Randolph. Just like him, on my way. Doesn't say when he'll arrive, doesn't even say where he's going, although it's bound to be Tet Yaroa. The big oaf couldn't even sign his name. What's he afraid of? But then she realized that Dan Randolph had much to be afraid of. She was luring him into a trap, not a romantic rendezvous. She was going to defeat him, crush him once and for all. She fought back the tears that were welling in her eyes. An earthquake shook the Tokyo airport just as Dan was being greeted by the head of the Yamagata security team, a bone-thin man of about 50, dressed in a severe suit of dead black, who bowed to him and asked, "Mr. Rutherford-san?" Dan started to return the bow when the floor beneath him rippled. The crowd streaming past, coming off the plane from Sydney, seemed to freeze and draw in its breath as if preparing to scream. A deep rumble filled the air like the drawn-out thunder of a dragon lurking beneath the ground. The long decorative streamers hanging from the ceiling high overhead swayed back and forth. Beyond the heads of the people facing him, Dan could see through the big windows on the other side of the terminal that the planes out there seemed to bob up and down like ships on a choppy sea. Then it was over. The rumble died away. Before anyone could scream. Before Dan had fully registered that an earthquake was happening. It was over. The floor became solid again. The planes outside were still as if they had never moved at all. The streamers fluttered only slightly, as if a passing breeze had briefly disturbed them. The crowd flowed back into motion, babbling and chattering. "Mr. Rutherford-san," the security man repeated, his immobile face showing neither anxiety nor relief. "Your transportation is waiting for you." "Domo arigato," Dan replied. He had not spoken Japanese in years, but he had spent his time on the spacecraft and hypersonic transport from Sydney, listening to newscasts from Tokyo to revive his ear for the language. "You have luggage, sir?" the man asked, switching to Japanese. "Only this," Dan hefted his soft-sided travel bag. Originally dead black, it looked gray and threadbare from much use.
"This way, please."
The security man did not offer to take Dan's bag. He's not a porter, and he wants to have both his hands free at all times, Dan told himself. Glad that he had kept up his daily regimen of exercises while on the moon, Dan followed after the security man on legs that felt only slightly rubbery in the heavy gravity of Earth. He looked around for the rest of the team. The terminal was crowded, abuzz with hundreds of conversations in a score of different languages, people scurrying everywhere. Mothers dragging crying children, red-faced businessmen rushing to their heart attacks, tourists looking sweaty and lost. Half a dozen younger men and women hurrying along the terminal corridor looked as if they might be security types, but it was impossible to single them out from the rest of the crowd. So far so good, Dan told himself. Nobody but size people knows I'm in Japan. I'll have my Caracas office contact Jane and tell her I'll be a day or two late for Tet Yaroa.
Give them a bit of time to check out the island, too.